Today is Tuesday, March 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Updated figures from Myanmar now put the death toll at over 500 since the start of protests against the February 1st coup.
It's terrible. It's absolutely outrageous. An awful lot of people have been killed totally unnecessarily.
Plus, a container ship that's been blocking the Suez Canal is now free.
Said the knock-on effects on global shipping could take weeks or months to unravel.
And press freedom in Bangladesh. We'll have these stories and more next. The United States on Monday suspended a trade deal with Myanmar until a democratic government is restored to the Southeast Asian country after a bloody February 1st coup. U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai said the United States was immediately suspending all U.S. engagement with Burma under the 2013 Trade and Investment Framework Agreement. Under the agreement, the two countries cooperated on trade and investment issues, a reward for the military's decision to allow a return to democracy, a transition that ended abruptly with last month's coup. An advocacy group says Myanmar security forces have killed at least 510 civilians in nearly 2 months of efforts to stop the protests of thousands of people who have taken to the streets again despite the growing toll. The Assistance Association for Political Prisoners said another 14 civilians were killed on Monday. The organization also released updated figures for previous days, now putting the total killed on Saturday, the bloodiest day thus far, at 141. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres again condemned the military's actions.
I'm very worried. I see with a lot of concern the fact that apparently many of these trends look irreversible, but hope is the last thing we can give up on. My message to the military is very simple. Stop the killings. Stop the repression of the demonstrations, release the political prisoners, and return power to those that have the legitimate right to exercise it.
Other world leaders, including U.S. President Joe Biden, condemn reports that Myanmar's armed forces opened fire at a funeral near Yangon on Sunday. Reuters' Jason Albano has that part of the story.
After Myanmar's military reportedly opened fire at a funeral, they drew harsh international condemnation on Monday. That's on top of more than 100 people killed over the weekend in the worst crackdown on anti-military protests since the coup began 2 months ago. According to news reports and witnesses, at least six children between the ages of 10 and 16 were among those killed on Saturday. In Yangon, mourners at the Sunday funeral service of a 20-year-old student said they were forced to flee after being shot at. No casualties were immediately reported. Hours later, U.S. President Joe Biden condemned the military.
It's terrible. It's absolutely outrageous. An awful lot of people have been killed totally unnecessarily.
The UN Special Rapporteur for Myanmar said the army was carrying out mass murder. He called for an isolation of the junta, cutting off its funding for oil and gas, as well as halting its access to weapons. The EU's top diplomat, Josep Borrell, called on Myanmar's generals to stand down from what he said was a senseless path of violence against their own people. Myanmar's junta took power on February 1st, while elected leader Aung San Suu Kyi remains in detention at an undisclosed location. Foreign criticism and sanctions imposed by some Western nations have failed so far to sway military leaders. Hundreds of people have died in the ongoing protests since the coup began.
Reuters reporter Jason Albano. Thai authorities deny they forced back more than 2,000 refugees who have fled airstrikes in Myanmar. But a local official says it's government policy for the army to block them at the border and deny access to outside aid groups. The giant ship container that has been blocking the Suez Canal for almost a week has been fully floated. Maha Al-Badrawi from Reuters News has more.
The 430-yard behemoth, known as the Ever Given, became stuck diagonally across a southern section of the canal in high winds on the 23rd of March when it ran aground, blocking a trade route that is used by about 15% of the world's shipping traffic for 6 days. And costing the canal $14 to $15 million a day. Marcus Baker is the head of marine and cargo at Marsh Incorporated. He says it highlights the importance and vulnerability of the world's global supply chain.
I mean, this is a very significant maritime artery, one of only two major canals in the world that, you know, operate in this way in terms of moving ships from one ocean to another. You know, you've got to remember that 90% of the world's goods are moved by ship. That's why the maritime industry is still so incredibly important for global trade. So any blockage of any kind that delays things has an unprecedented impact on global trade. And that's exactly what we've seen in the last week.
The Suez Canal Authority's chairman, Admiral Osama Arabi, has said that investigations will show that the organization wasn't responsible for the incident. After dredging and excavation work over the weekend, rescue workers from the authority and a team from Dutch firm Smith Salvage succeeded in partially refloating the ship earlier on Monday using tugboats, according to marine and shipping sources. The Ever Given is now being moved to a lake that sits along the canal for inspection. Admiral Rabi has also said it could take from 2.5 to 3 days to clear the traffic jam of other ships. Shipping group Maersk said the knock-on effects on global shipping could take weeks or months to unravel.
Reuters' Maha Albajani. The former Minneapolis, Minnesota police officer charged with killing George Floyd went on trial Monday. In opening statements heard on Court TV, prosecutor Jerry Blackwell told the jury that Derek Chauvin put his knee on Floyd's neck and his back until the very life was squeezed out of him.
The video evidence, I think, will be very helpful and meaningful to you because you can see it for yourself without lawyer talk, lawyer spin, lawyer anything.
Derek Chauvin's defense attorney Eric Nelson on Court TV argued that Floyd was resisting arrest and Chauvin arrived to assist other officers.
Derek Chauvin did exactly what he had been trained to do over the course of his 19-year career. The use of force is not attractive, but it is a necessary component of policing.
Chauvin is charged with unintentional second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and manslaughter. A trial opened in Paris Monday over the 2004 bombing of a French military base in then-war-torn Ivory Coast that killed an American soil scientist and 9 French soldiers. The defendants are being tried in absentia. Lisa Bryant reports that nearly 2 decades later, the attack and the French government's response is raising many questions.
2 Ivorian soldiers and a mercenary from Belarus stand accused of the 2004 bombing at the French army base near Bouake, Ivory Coast's second largest city, held by rebels at the time when the country was in the middle of a civil war. The whereabouts of the 3 men are unknown, one of the many mysteries surrounding this trial. Relations between Ivory Coast and its former colonial power, France, were at a low point when the bombing took place. Anti-French sentiment, especially against its Licorne peacekeeping operation there, was high. Paris was accused of aiding rebels fighting then-President Laurent Gbagbo. France responded to the Bouake attack by destroying Ivory Coast's tiny air force. Some believe the attack was a blunder by Ivorian authorities. Former French ambassador to Ivory Coast, Jean-Marc Simon, told Radio France International he believed even former President Gbagbo had not been informed of it in advance, but suggested high-level members of Gbagbo's government must have given the orders.
Il s'agissait pour moi d'un bombardement délibéré pour mettre en difficulté la France.
Lawyer Lionel Bethune de Moreau, representing some of the civil parties in the case, told Agence France-Presse News Service he believes the attack was deliberate by Ivorian authorities as a way to get France to leave Ivory Coast. Still others suggest the bombing was a plot by France to trigger Gbagbo's departure. It's a hypothesis raised by another lawyer of families of the victims, but dismissed by Ambassador Simon as a conspiracy theory. There are also questions about why the 3 defendants were never caught and international arrest warrants against them not carried out. France's former ministers of defense, interior, and foreign affairs have been called as witnesses in this trial.
Ça fait 17 ans qu'on attend ce procès.
Bernadette Delon, sister of one of the victims, told AFP she doesn't expect this trial to resolve anything. It comes as the International Criminal Court in The Hague rules Wednesday on whether to uphold its earlier acquittal of Gbagbo on charges related to post-electoral violence in Ivory Coast in 2010. If that happens, reports say, the former president plans to go home.
Honnêtement, je pense que ça ne suscite pas autant d'engouement que...
In Abidjan, Willie Nett, coordinator for the International Federation for Human Rights in Ivory Coast, says many Ivorians have turned the page on the traumatic events of 2004. He expects few will closely follow this Paris trial. Still, Nett says political opinions remain sharply divided on France. They're mostly negative when it comes to opposition figures supporting former President Gbagbo, while the current government of President Alassane Ouattara and his supporters consider France a key international partner. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. World Health Organization Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says despite leaked reports about the results of an agency-sponsored probe into the origins of the virus that causes COVID-19, the findings will be formally presented by the mission experts Tuesday.
And we will read the report and discuss, digest its content and next steps with member states. But as I have said, all hypotheses are on the table and warrant complete and further studies from what I have seen so far.
The report is being closely watched since discovering the origins of the virus could help scientists prevent future pandemics. But it's also extremely sensitive, since China bristles at any suggestion that it is to blame for the current pandemic. The report comes as the coronavirus has infected over 127 million people, according to the Johns Hopkins University Coronavirus Resource Center. Nearly 2.8 million people have died from COVID-19 around the world. Mexico has revised its coronavirus death toll figures, increasing the tally by 60%, which makes it one of the top three nations with the highest death tolls. The new statistics are staggering, as the Mexican population of 126 million is far below the populations of both the United States and Brazil. Journalists in Bangladesh say the 2018 Digital Security Act is being used to harass and jail members of the media. Sanjana Faraz has the details.
Since it was passed in 2018, journalists and media experts have warned that Bangladesh's Digital Security Act could be open to abuse. Those warnings grew louder after the death in custody of journalist Mushtaq Ahmed. Photojournalist Shofiqul Islam Kajol was detained for almost 2 months over social media posts.
I was arrested and taken to prison, and it's said in the news that I went missing. You know what happened. In fact, I do not want to go back to that context, and you also have an idea why I don't want to. I cannot speak the truth about what happened.
Journalists in Bangladesh already come under pressure from both the government and opposition. The Digital Security Act increased the risk of arrest, with over 50 journalists charged under it in the first half of 2020.
This digital security law is in force more on journalists in the outskirts of Dhaka, and there were many instances where journalists have been harassed for speaking the truth.
International media organizations and local journalists say provisions in the law mean it could be used to impede journalism and have called on the government to repeal it.
We have demanded changes in the Digital Security Act so that journalists or any other person who expresses their opinion in any form can be ensured of security from law enforcement. The non-bailable clause needs to be changed, and at the same time, no one can misuse it.
The Committee to Protect Journalists spoke with the government officials in 2017, who acknowledged problems with the previous internet law known as the ICT Act, and promised to implement safeguards. But media are still being targeted.
The ICT Act, which was essentially completely repackaged with a different name, now the Digital Security Act, and it is, if anything, being used and misused even more than we saw a few years ago.
Broadcasters say concerns over abuse of the law are justified.
Section 41 of this act is very much one of a police state. If an officer believes any news report of mine or anyone can harm the state or be a security threat, then they can search and arrest the person without an arrest warrant.
Government official says a committee has been formed to ensure the law is enforced correctly.
If anybody and everybody alleges digital a crime under the Digital Security Act, I am saying that immediately it will not be registered as a case. It will go to a cell where the allegations will be taken, examined, and after examining, if these allegations really formulate a case under the Digital Security Act, only then it will be registered as a case under the Digital Security Act.
The use of the act to harass journalists and the February death of journalist Mushtaq Ahmed, who was arrested under the terms of the act and died in prison, are believed to be behind the government's plans to make changes to the act, journalists say. Sanjana Feroz, VOA News, Washington.
On Monday, North Korea said that the United Nations Security Council showed a double standard as its sanctions committee criticized the country's recent missile test as a violation of UN resolutions. Reuters' Brian Wood reports.
North Korea launched a new type of tactical short-range ballistic missile last week. At the committee meeting on Friday, the United States called for more sanctions on Pyongyang. On Monday, top North Korean official Jo Chol-soo said in state media that the UN meeting was, quote, designed to negate the right of our state to self-defense. He also said that it does not make any sense that only our righteous self-defensive measure should be singled out for denunciation when many other countries across the globe are firing all kinds of projectiles for the purpose of increasing their military strength. Jo warned North Korea would devise a countermeasure. It comes after Pyongyang said over the weekend that the U.S.'s criticism of its missile test was a wrong first step and revealed, quote, deep-seated hostility.
Brian Wood from Reuters.
This is Science in a Minute.
According to early scientific studies, the SARS coronavirus 2, which causes COVID-19, has been known to primarily infect the body's upper airways and lungs. Further research found that cells in other parts of the body, including the digestive system, blood vessels, and kidneys, can also be infected with the novel coronavirus. A new National Institutes of Health and University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill-led study suggests SARS-CoV-2 can infect cells in the mouth, salivary glands, and gums. Study findings suggest that the mouth may be involved with spreading the novel coronavirus to the lungs or gastrointestinal system through saliva that's packed with virus-infected cells from the mouth. Study authors say more research is needed to learn about the mouth's role in the infection and spread of SARS coronavirus 2 inside and outside the body. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Last week, a bipartisan group of former U.S. government officials issued a statement condemning the spike in crimes against Asian Americans, saying the increase comes as Asians face wrongful blame for the virus. Citing statistics provided by the nonprofit group Stop AAPI Hate, an acronym for Asian American and Pacific Islanders, the signatories say 2020 witnessed a 150% increase in hate crimes against Asian Americans. Among those who signed the document is Curtis S. Chin. He served as the U.S. ambassador to the Asian Development Bank under both Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama. He's also currently an Asian fellow at the Milken Institute, a nonprofit, nonpartisan economic think tank. I began our conversation by asking for his thoughts on why some in American society are still considered outsiders or others. The United States is a nation of immigrants dating back to the original colonies.
When we think of the United States today, the reality is that the images that you see, whether it's in Hollywood or in newspapers or in books, is of a nation that, yes, was founded by immigrants, but the demographics, which are still changing, is of a white nation, of a nation that really was shaped early on by the first settlers from England that came here. So fast forward to what is going on today. If you think about America today, yes, America is evolving. But the reality is that it is a country where many of the leaders, many of the faces that we see on TV are white Americans. You know, that's neither good or bad. What, though, needs to change is that the face of America is changing, but so too must be the face of our leaders, of our business leaders, of our government leaders. What we're seeing today, you know, in my view, is a continuation of really what happened in many ways last year when the Black Lives Matter movement really burst onto the scene. But remember, Black Lives Matter didn't just begin last year. This ongoing reckoning of America with regards to race, with regard to women, is one that has gone on, you know, perhaps, you know, for decades. The reality is that when I think about anti-Asian hate right now and all that is happening, is that we need to also think about it in terms of the context. That, you know, President Biden, to his great credit, when he called out anti-Asian hate and said, this is un-American, this is not America. Sadly, in many ways, this legacy, this present anti-Asian hate spike in violence is also been part of America.
You bring up President Biden and his statement against Asian hate, and you were part of a number of individuals, of former government officials, who released a statement condemning Asian hate. Are statements enough to affect change?
Absolutely not. Clearly, it's a step that I think all of us need to condemn racist behavior. But we need to now, you know, turn that greater awareness of what is going on into action. You know, we've seen this with regards to the Black Lives Matter movement. March is actually also National Women's History Month in the United States. And now we're seeing with this pushback against Asian hate, people are calling out racist incidents. That's terrific. But now we need to turn that into more specific actions. So the United States, it can range from federal government, you know, nationwide legislation that passes or that takes place in Washington. You know, that's good. You know, so that would include things like calling for money to help fund the tracking of hate crimes. That it would include laws that look into really what is happening out there in communities with regards to discrimination, with regards to racist violence. So all that's important. But also what's important in the United States is also for actions to happen at that community level. You know, unlike, let's say, the Black community, which also has faced terrible discrimination and continues to do so, the Asian American community is made up of probably, you know, dozens or more of ethnicities with people speaking different languages. You know, for many, English is not their first language. So as you think about, you know, what can we do to address these hate crimes happening in America, I say, well, you need to talk to the communities that are being impacted the most. And that will mean doing things in Korean, in Japanese, in Chinese, and the range of languages that the diverse and complex Asian American community speaks here in the United States.
Then do you see this as a watershed moment to affect the change that you just outlined?
The ongoing spike in anti-Asian violence in some ways is a watershed moment here in America, in that so many more people, so much more media are focused on that ongoing really legacy and heritage and history still unfolding of anti-Asian hate. But my concern is that it is just one of many watershed moments in America's push and search for that more perfect union. So yes, right now we are seeing a watershed moment in the focus on anti-Asian American hate, but it is simply one of many watershed moments. My hope is that what is happening now will lead indeed to progress towards a more perfect union. It shouldn't take these kinds of incidents to focus America on the history and on what is needed to stop Asian hate and move this country forward.
Curtis S. Chen is an Asia Fellow with the Milken Institute. And finally, women have made important economic and business gains in the past few years. A lot of work remains to reach gender equality in innovation and technology. In Nigeria, The nonprofit Women's Technology Empowerment Center uses innovative approaches to encourage more girls to pursue technology careers. For more, Africa 54 correspondent Paula Ndiho spoke with Orio Luwalesi, founder and executive director of the organization in Lagos, Nigeria, via Skype.
You lead an organization that empowers a lot of women in the field of science and technology. Let's start there. What do you do exactly?
Thank you so much for that question. I run a nonprofit called the Women's Technology Empowerment Center, WTECH. It's based in Lagos, Nigeria. And what we do is we equip girls and women with technology skills. So for instance, programming, building mobile applications, website design, graphic design, robotics. And so we're really trying to get girls interested in technology and technology related careers and supporting them as they start to pursue careers in technology.
When these young women come to you, or women in general come to you, what are their concerns? What is it they are looking for?
We work with girls in secondary school. So one of our flagship programs is our She Creates Camp, where we are working with girls between the ages of 13 to 17. And there we're helping them build technology skills, helping them to become technology creators, introducing them to role models already in the technology space. So when they come to us, I mean, they're still in school, so they're still open to learning a lot. They don't really have a lot of preconceived notions yet about, you know, oh, tech is for me or tech is not for me.
Are there some examples of success stories of women that have gone through your training who are out there doing their thing?
We've empowered just over 31,000 girls and women. So that means that these girls and women have passed through our programs and they're now doing different things, not all of them in technology. So 86% of our alumni were inspired to work within science, technology, and engineering field after attending our program. We have close to 25% who actually went on to study a STEM-related degree or are currently working in that space. And then we have about 56% of our alumni who have been able to earn some kind of income using the skills that they got from our program.
Who inspires you?
Wow, so many people inspire me. I'm sure it's a cliche to say, you know, your mother, but that was my first role model anyway, because she was an engineer and she was doing so much. There's her, there's another lady in Nigeria, a former minister of communication technology. Her name is Dr. Mobola Johnson, and she really inspires me as well.
Why is Nigeria, especially Lagos where you are, a very attractive place for all these tech companies?
It's a very dynamic city, and whatever is happening, you know, outside in the world, you tend to see it, you know, very quickly in Lagos, maybe more in Lagos than other parts of the country. I mean, there's definitely a huge talent pool here in Lagos. There's great access to technology. Also, because of technology, the internet, you really can be anywhere, especially in technology. You can live anywhere and then work, you know, remotely. Because of COVID, we're going to see, we've already started seeing more of that, you know, jobs are no longer tied to specific locations, but they are open to people, you know, wherever they may be.
How has this COVID impacted your business? How has it impacted the industry?
Well, it's impacted the industry, definitely. I mean, last year, I think, was really the year of tech. In case anyone was in any doubts, I mean, we now know that, you know, technology is crucial for businesses, it's crucial for economies, it's crucial for healthcare, education. We saw literally every facet of our life being mediated, you know, by technology. I mean, in our organization, of course, we started working from home. We were able to seamlessly move, well, I shouldn't say seamlessly, but almost seamlessly, you know, transit to working from home. We had to move most of our programs online as well. And we found that we were able to do so much more with technology. I think for an organization whose work is centered on technology, it also made me realize that we were not even utilizing the potential of technology even to the nth degree. There was just so much more we could do. being online opened up our programs to the world. So we were working with girls and young women across continents. It's really been good in that sense.
Thank you so much for your time. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. I enjoyed the conversation as well.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.